This is an ABC podcast.
Gwyn Dyer is a Canadian journalist and author. He was trained as an historian, and Gwyn has served in the navies of not one, not two, but three different nations: Canada, the US, and the UK, where he's based now. A while back, Gwyn wrote a classic book on the practice of war throughout the ages, which was made into a TV series. Gwyn Dyer has appeared on Conversations several times in the past, and we've always talked about horrible, gloomy things like war and civilizational upheaval and decline. And today, given how things have been going in the world recently, I thought we'd be getting Gwyn Dyer in full-blown apocalyptic mode. But Gwyn's new book is surprisingly upbeat. Gwyn thinks the current turmoil in the world doesn't have to be a prelude to war and chaos. He says it's a sign of growing pains as the world enters a new phase. A phase where automation will increase wealth and productivity, but at the same time it'll continue to eliminate countless jobs all over the developed world. And he says this means we're going to have to find ways to put real money into the pockets of people who have no paying jobs. Gwyn Dyer's book is called Growing Pains, and his conversation was recorded at the recent Canberra Writers' Festival. Gwyn, you begin by saying that the world owes Donald Trump a huge vote of thanks. Why does the world owe Donald Trump a huge vote of thanks?
Because he showed us that things were going wrong, and we weren't really aware of it. I don't think anybody knew in 2015 that 62 million people were angry enough at their situation in life that they would vote for a clown like this. And they did, and they're not, 62 million people like Donald Trump. They're perfectly decent, ordinary people whom circumstances has driven into such desperation that they voted for him. Okay, many people voted for him because their grandfathers and grandmothers had voted Republican and so on, but that wouldn't have got him into the White House. The votes that put him into the White House were angry, mostly unemployed or about to be unemployed people, in particularly the Rust Belt states, where automation had destroyed the jobs already. And he had figured that one thing out. I mean, you listen, it's always jobs. With Donald Trump, it's always jobs, and the reasons he gives for the disappearance of the jobs is wrong, but nevertheless, he had hit the right note to get 62 million Americans to vote for him. And most of the ones who put him over the top in the Rust Belt states were precisely the people who had been betrayed by the economy. As they saw it, they had lost their jobs. Where did they go? Trump told them they'd been sent abroad. It's not true, but nevertheless, he came up with the answer. It was in the first primary in New Hampshire, which he won. He made a speech right after that in which he said, I don't know what the real unemployment rate is. It's 20%, 25%. I've heard 32%. Official unemployment in the United States is 3.9%. And he's wrong. It's not that high, but it's far higher than 3.9%, probably around 15. And he focused on that and got elected, but he also alerted an awful lot of people to what's going on, and we are beginning to respond to that. And frankly, if Mrs. Clinton had won the election in 2016, we wouldn't have noticed that what was going on for another 4 years, and that is the time we probably can't afford to waste before we address the issue.
As you say, the official unemployment rate in the United States right now is 3.9%. Now, conventionally, that's a figure where most economists and politicians would say that's pretty much full employment. What evidence is there that it's a vastly higher figure, like the kind of figure you just brought out?
Well, there's the key number is there's a fellow called Nicholas Eberstadt who works at the American Enterprise Institute, not renowned for its left-wing connections. And he did a study 2 years ago in which basically instead of, doing the usual thing when you work out unemployment, which is you punch the button on the computer that says how many people said they were looking for jobs last week, applied, filled out forms. He said, let's just pick a week and ask us, a statistical sample, 20,000, 30,000, 40,000 people, were you working last week? And the answer he came back with was that of American men of prime working age, 24 to 55 years old, 17.5% were not working last week. They were on welfare, perhaps, in which case they get noticed, but if they haven't signed on for looking for a job, they don't get counted. And many of them have moved on from that to, for example, disability, in which case they're certainly not counted as unemployed. I'm not suggesting that everybody on the disability rolls is faking it, far from it, but the number of people who are claiming disability in the United States has doubled in the past 20 years.
Doubled,
and the number who have complaints that are very hard to disprove, mental problems, back problems, things you can't, you know, you say you've got it, we can't prove you don't, has also doubled. It's up to about 50% of people claiming disability. So you go and you ask the right question, and the answer is 17.5%. It looks bad to have 17% unemployment, so let's find a way to make it a different number.
So with that high unemployment figure, this is what you say is really the source of growing rage against the entirety of the system. This is what is goading voters to kick really hard against the system.
Well, yes, I think so. They feel abandoned. They feel betrayed. And, of course, there's another, element to add to the witch's brew here, which is that wages for people in real money, take the inflation out, have basically been stagnant in the United States for 35 years. There is no advance, and indeed in many cases there have been relatively modest but real declines in real income, particularly in the manufacturing parts of the United States, which of course is the clue. What's going on here really is automation, the elimination of jobs. Simplest thing in the world to automate is an assembly line job, because we've already taken a very complex job and broken it down into 200 relatively simple jobs. And each of those relatively simple jobs is not that hard to write the programming, the algorithms to automate. And so it was practically the first major activity to get automated. And that actually started happening in the 90s. And so you have, 17.5% nationally, but in the Rust Belt states, which got Mr. Trump into office, particularly Pennsylvania and Michigan,
Ohio,
and Wisconsin,
yeah.
It's probably 25%.
So you say that Trump was the politician to say things are bad, the unemployment rate is much higher than what everyone's talking about. What's his elixir? What's his explanation for that high unemployment?
Evil foreigners. the evil foreigners who came in illegally and are taking jobs away from good, native-born, white Americans. And the other evil foreigners who come in and stole all the factories, right? And you can see the Chinese and the Mexicans sneaking in at night, and by, factory under the coat and out by morning. They've taken the jobs and put them in Mexico. They've taken the jobs and put them in China. Now, some of that did happen in the 1990s.
Yeah, and I'm thinking the Apple computer produces its hardware China. General Motors, I think, has produced its
mostly in central Mexico. Yeah,
yeah, that's right. So what's wrong with what he's saying there?
Well, that happened a lot in the 90s. Probably 2 million jobs were sent abroad in the 1990s, although it wasn't evil foreigners. It was American CEOs who reckoned that it's a lot better to make cars in central Mexico and pay people $3 an hour than pay them $25 an hour in Detroit. And we get the other 22, So it was actually American capital that decided to move the jobs abroad. But they did go abroad in the 1990s. That has almost entirely stopped. What's been going on in the past almost 20 years now, since the turn of the century, the jobs are not going anywhere. They're evaporating. They were automated out of existence. And quite often, the factories are still there. In Detroit, there's this enormous 2-kilometer-long factory, the River Rouge plant. Henry Ford originally built it. And, believe it or not, the cars are still spewing out the far end of that factory. The only way you would know something's changed is if you look at the employee parking lot, that's about 9/10 empty. They got rid of the jobs in place. And that has been going on sufficiently to give us the kind of very high unemployment rate that the Americans really have and deny they have. I mean, Trump, he's like the canary in the coal mine. You know, he actually said there's really massive unemployment here. And the people who voted for him in those states, by the way, those are Democratic states, all heavily trade union. They switched. They switched from voting Democratic to voting for Mr. Trump because he actually acknowledged what had happened to them.
So that's his success. He acknowledges this truth that no one else was talking about.
Giant orange canary.
He's the giant orange canary in the coal mine, as you say. And how he fits on that perch, I have no idea. But nonetheless, there he is. But where you think he's wrong is in where he says those jobs have gone.
There's almost no jobs going abroad anymore. In fact, there's an interesting new phenomenon called reshoring.
What is reshoring?
Reshoring is where the jobs you sent abroad to Mexico or China 20 years ago are now being brought back to the United States because, in fact, with automation, you only have to employ about a tenth of the people you used to employ. And therefore, the wage bill isn't a great deterrent to bringing the jobs home. And, of course, now you're working in a language you know with a relatively predictable legal system. So we're going to bring the factory back. Don't expect the jobs that went to come back, however. I mean, even in China, you're finding that they're shedding jobs in factories. The same thing is happening everywhere.
Trump has often said that free trade has also been a job killer for Americans. There's a strong belief in certain parts of Australia that were once manufacturing or industrial heartlands that that's the case here as well. Hence him pulling out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, him making ominous noises about the North American Free Trade Agreement as well. What's your sense of the truth of that?
Well, I think there is some truth in it, obviously, but it's not the key factor. I mean, there's always a certain amount of churn and you know, sort of the jobs go to the lower wage workers in some other country. That's been going on since the late 18th century. But this is not what has caused the crisis. Most manufacturing jobs, it's not worth moving them abroad, but it's definitely worth automating them at home. And that is what is happening. So, you know, there was a brief period in the 90s when there was a lot of offshoring going on. It's pretty well stopped. 5 million jobs, manufacturing jobs, lost in the United States since the turn of the century, and 85% of them didn't go anywhere. They were eliminated by automation.
You mentioned Detroit there. Huge changes are coming to cars, the kind of cars we have and whether we're going to drive them or not. I was in Europe earlier this year, and one thing I've noticed, we don't see it so much here at all, but electric cars are really common in Europe these days. There are whole like streets, side streets, where you can plug your car in at night.
Yeah.
I hear it's becoming more common in China and other places as well. What's the future for electric cars that you see?
Well, I think that they're bound to become the dominant feature because, in fact, there is legislation in both France and Britain, for example, which will make it illegal to have petrol-fueled cars on the road by 2040, which means, in effect, that nobody will buy them after 2035 because you don't buy a car that's going to become illegal in 5 years. So that's what, 15, 14 years away, you know.
Are electric cars easier to manufacture than the standard internal combustion engine cars?
Well, they're a good deal easier to manage because internal combustion engine is a complete Heath Robinson or Rube Goldberg, I'm not sure what you say in Australia, but it's a completely fantastic piece of machinery that is incredibly complicated, clumsy. After 100 years, we've got most of the bugs out. My car stopped breaking down about 25 years ago. But it is still a ridiculous way to, you know, get yourself power. Then there's the pollution aspect, the greenhouse gases and so on. So that actually there's legislation coming in place which will make these cars no longer suitable for use on the road within a reasonably close horizon.
And what's this mean for the future of oil-rich or oil-exporting countries like Saudi Arabia and Russia?
Well, they're screwed. I talk to Saudis about this from time to time because, you know, they do live off this stuff. And there is awareness that it isn't forever, that, in fact, they're never going to sell all that they've got in the ground now. The Crown Prince, who's currently in charge, or rather adventurous man, sometimes mistakenly, but he's definitely into restructuring the Saudi economy, diversifying, so that when you can't, not when the oil runs out, but when you haven't got a market for it anymore, there's still something for everybody to do here that will make money. I'm not sure it'll work, actually. There's not any good reason for 27 million people to be there if there's not some oil. But he's trying his best to move away from sole dependence on oil because he knows what's coming. Everybody knows.
When you think of the mischief that countries, and mischief is a kind of light word, really, that countries like Russia and Saudi Arabia get up to with the benefits of oil wealth, that kind of, or the prognostications there look pretty good, I suppose, in that sense.
Well, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't feel really heartbroken if Saudi Arabia couldn't export its imams to the mosques all over the planet. Because with it, it is exporting a form of Islam that is extremely radical and frankly hostile, Salafi Islam. But, you know, it's pretty difficult for Muslim communities in the West to turn down a free trained imam and a big contribution to the mosque. And so anything that would stop them from doing that sort of thing would be very helpful. And, of course, they're doing the same thing all through the Arab and Muslim world.
So that's one consequence of where technology is leading us in the car world. What about self-driving cars?
Well, it'd be better than me driving them anyway.
what kind of
curb twice on the way here.
What kind of consequences do you see from self-driving cars?
Well, first of all, obviously, a crash in the number of cars on the road, because the business model, and by the way, Uber already has this as its ultimate goal, is that you don't bother owning your own car anymore. You got your mobile and you phone a car and it shows up at, you know, within a minute, and you hop in and you tell it where to go and you get out, no cash changes hands. And in that case, you only need about a quarter of the cars we now have on the road. In fact, there's only ever about a quarter of the cars on the road at the same time. So you can sort of get rid of all the rest. And even, you know, senior CEOs in the automobile industry, there's one report I saw quite recently, and I think KPMG held a meeting of senior CEOs in the automobile industry who agreed that by 2025, only half the population will be buying cars anymore.
What kind of jobs disappear, though, when we have self-driving cars?
Oh, well, right away, all the jobs that are paid driving jobs, which in the United States is 4.5 million, bus drivers, taxi drivers, long-distance lorry drivers, get replaced. Delivery van drivers a little bit slower because they have to get out of the vehicle at the end and carry the package up. But nevertheless, even that can be dealt with, drones and so on. There go that lot of jobs. I mean, in terms of what else is automation destroying at the moment, it's not automation, but computers, it's retail jobs. All the big department stores are crashing and the, you know, everybody's buying online. And
malls are closing across the United States,
oh,
too.
Yeah. Malls are I mean, there's some that are completely empty. It's happening, big department stores closing down, things like that. There's an awful lot of jobs going there.
So normally, though, when we talk about this happening, like, I mean, you know, we didn't have people opposing the introduction of the light bulb because it would threaten jobs in the candle industry. I mean, that didn't happen.
It probably did, actually.
Well, it did. I'm sure it did. But nonetheless, isn't it natural in human endeavor that we create new industries? We come up with ideas for new things and people go to work making those. Won't those jobs that are eliminated from automation, won't new ones appear in these new industries, of which we don't know will even exist now?
But why do you think the new industries will need people? You know, I mean, there is a fantasy, it's a very amiable belief, which is that, you know, computers destroy jobs over here, but on the other hand, over here, they create the same number of new jobs, better jobs, jobs that you can have if you just upgrade your skills a bit. This is the story we tell them at bedtime. It's just not true. Computers might create some new jobs, but it's the ratio is 3 lost or 4 lost for every new one created. I mean, and what happens, of course, is in most cases that you lose your good steady job with a pension at the end of it or a good hourly wage. You don't immediately go on the unemployed rolls. You bounce down onto minimum wage jobs with 0 hours contracts and things like that, and you bump along the bottom like that for a while before you age out and have no job at the age of 50. But, you know, you're not going to go into another great job This is not what's happening.
You mentioned your book, One Potential Policy Solution, that's gaining traction all over the world. And this is, I think, the third time I've been talking about this in the last 12 months, the concept of a universal basic income. Would you just like to describe how you see that working?
Well, I think that the general idea, and it's not my idea, but I see it as a sort of possible rescue for what is otherwise going to be a pretty grim society. I mean, the idea is that everybody, whether they are working or not, gets a basic wage which is adequate to lead a comfortable, though not lavish, lifestyle. You have a roof over your head and it doesn't leak. You have transportation if you're still buying cars, but that will fade out, I imagine. You can put food on the table, clothes on your kids' backs, and maybe even take a holiday once a year for a couple of weeks, though, you know, only within the state. But you're also free, if there are jobs, to take one. And you will, of course, be taxed on that. And you'll be in a higher tax bracket because you're already getting the basic income, so we'll claw some of the money back that way. And you'll also get a lot of money back because, of course, you don't get the basic income plus unemployment insurance, plus welfare payments, plus all the rest of it. You know, all of that gets rolled into the basic income. But what it does is two things. Actually, it does three things. First of all, it guarantees that you won't actually starve in a gutter and you don't have to go begging. Secondly, you are not humiliated by it. And humiliation is at least half the pain of unemployment. Losing your job hurts. And it's not just because you don't have money in your pocket. You feel like a loser. And you know other people see you as a loser. They shouldn't, but they do. And you're angry about that because most people did nothing wrong when they lost their jobs. It was a decision made in a head office hundreds of kilometers from here. So a universal basic income, everybody gets it, no humiliation. You know, like the old age pension. I've never met anybody angry about getting the old age pension.
Or universal health care. We have it in Australia. We've had it for 35, 40 years. Yeah, that's not seen as a humiliation.
But the other thing it does, actually, and it's an important thing if it should happen, is that it narrows the gap between the rich and the rest, in the sense that it raises the floor everybody's standing on by, let's say, $20,000 a year. It would mean nothing to get the universal basic income if you were Bill Gates. In fact, it's a rounding error, you know, in your income. But if you are actually unemployed and you got that, suddenly the gap narrows drastically. If you are unemployed and working, the gap narrows even more. And I think that a huge amount of the anger is due to the size of the gap. We have gone from about a five-fold difference between the top 20% income and the bottom 20% income to an eight-fold gap in the United States, a seven-fold gap in the United Kingdom in the past 30 years. The rich are pulling away from the rest. And I think that's politically poisonous. And one of the things universal basic income would do is lift the rest up sufficiently to close that gap. I think that's okay. Can you afford it? Good question. There are various trial programs being run. One of them run, by the way, in the California, not by the state of California, but by the moguls of Silicon Valley, who Bill Gates and Elon Musk and people like that, who are running a trial project on universal basic income. Pick a few thousand people, give them the money, and see what they do with it. Do they still get up in the morning? Do they go out and work if they can find a job and so on? Why are they doing it? Maybe because they're public-spirited. Maybe because it's their fault they wrote the algorithms that made these people poor. And maybe just to avoid being hanged from a lamppost when the revolution comes. But for whatever reason, they're doing it. You know, we shall find out. It's a new idea, and it's a bit frightening. Large sums of money are being talked about here, but it may make a difference.
There is, I think, for a lot of people, the idea that you're talking about may seem wildly fanciful and right outside the realm of politics, but it is worth remembering that President Richard Nixon tried to introduce a universal basic income in the United States in the 1970s.
It wasn't universal, but it was a basic income for everybody below a certain income level, which was well above poverty level, would receive enough money to take them up to that level. And he actually brought that proposal to Congress twice, and I think it was 70 and 71.
And Hillary Clinton seriously contemplated running on a universal basic income as being part of her platform in 2016, but she declined to do so.
Lost her nerve, really.
Lost her nerve. Nonetheless, the hardest thing to get past with this, I think, is people have an innate dislike of someone getting money for nothing. How do you get past that?
I never had a problem as long as it's me. Well, okay, no, they don't. If there is some plausible reason that you're not working, if you're looking after children at home, there are only about half the population at any given time is actually adult population is actually working. There are many people not in the workforce because they're too rich to bother, or because they're ill or handicapped, or because they're parents looking after children, or looking after elderly parents of their own, or whatever. We don't despise those people. We do despise people who could be working but aren't. I kind of understand the psychology of it, but also when half of the population aren't working, and there is a forecast that 47% of existing American jobs will be eliminated by automation in the next 20 years, so by then you definitely are up to half the population not working, I suspect that that will tend to fall away.
Broadcast, podcast, and on the ABC Listen app. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
With a friend of mine the other day, both he and his wife have pretty demanding jobs. Both of them have fought like hell so they can work a four-day week, so they can have days at either end of the week where they can be home with their young children. He said that they're seen as being slack for doing this, but he said, when I was growing up, it was only my dad that went to work. Our family contributed 5 working days to the economy. My wife and I are contributing 8 now, and you're calling that slack? Something's changed here. Would a universal basic income allow more time for care of children and care of the elderly within the family?
I think it would, and it would also allow people... You know, we are a rich economy, and we're getting richer. Automation is making us richer. 7 million industrial jobs lost in the United States in the last 25 years, and industrial output has doubled. You know, we're not getting poorer. We're getting richer. It's a question of how do you put money into people's pockets if you don't need them on the assembly line. And as the number of people in that situation grows, I think attitudes will automatically migrate. If you're one of those people and you're now the majority, I suspect things will be seen differently. I mean, this is a process. We are in the middle of a process. We're not quite sure what the end point is, but big change is coming. And Mr. Trump has given us 4 more years to think about it. I mean, it would have been, you know, what you don't want to end up with is a future that looks like Blade Runner. And if you don't want that, you better start thinking about it, because the old full employment industrial society is going. So, you know, work out how you are going to navigate the transition, but there is going to be one.
One of the fears that's around at the moment is that democracy itself is in a state of crisis. Democracy seems to be withering in a great many places. It's not even looking too flash here right now. There's a kind of
It's a local problem.
It's a local problem, yeah, not beyond Canberra. Democratic institutions are losing prestige. I think it's fair to say that. Democracy is withering in countries. Certainly it has in Russia. It's withering in Poland, in the Czech Republic. It's withering badly in Hungary, in Turkey, in many other places as well. Do you think this indicates that democracy has been this kind of little blip in human history? Maybe it's a thing that's about to end, and it's been this kind of nice little interlude that has left us in a situation where people now want a strong man instead.
I don't think so, Richard. I think, first of all, you know, we are now 250 years into the process of democratization after approximately 10,000 years of tyranny. Right? There wasn't a single democratic country. Everybody in every country was under a king or an emperor or a dictator. And so it was with a few little blips like, you know, Greek city-states, and even there, 90% of the people weren't voting. And then suddenly, in the late 18th century, we start getting democracies. And I would actually say the reason is that we had mass communications, if only print, and literacy. But it meant that millions of people could be on the same page. They couldn't before. And once you put them on the same page, they realize, actually, we don't enjoy being ruled by a monarch. When you give people the ability to cooperate, to understand, in a way to have a debate about means and ends, and you create a society that is formally equal. Egalitarianism is what democracy is all about. It may not be, you know, it may not deliver complete equality, but it does deliver equality of rights. Now you're creating democracies, and 250 years later, there's hardly any country in the world that does not give lip service to this. Even the worst dictatorships hold fake elections. And actually about half the population of the planet lives in countries that are genuinely democratic, with enormous flaws, of course. Okay, now you pick on Hungary, dreadful situation there. You can find, I hate what's happening in Turkey. I used to live there, and it just tears my heart out to see what's happening there. Promising democracy undermined there. But, you know, for all its faults, India is 1,300,000,000 people living in a proper democracy. And 350 million in the United States and so on, and all of Europe except for the, you know, Hungary, which is 10 million people. We're not really in huge retrograde motion here. There are little local difficulties, but well, even some big local difficulties. I mean, you know, Thailand and you know, so on. But
I suppose what I'm getting at is any kind of political philosophy is grounded in an idea of human nature.
Yes.
So we have to talk about what kind of an animal a human is, really, when we want to understand whether we're naturally democratic in our nature.
You know, we're both, I think, in the sense that we have, as primates, as you know, if you look at all of our relatives, chimpanzees and gorillas and bonobos, and I don't know what your relatives are like.
The good-looking bonobos. Yeah.
Exactly. They live in brutal hierarchies. You know, the monkey king at the top beating up on everybody else. Horrible societies. And that is part of our heritage. We definitely do have drives for domination and instincts of submission, which allow you to live in that kind of brutal hierarchy. But on the other hand, we have a whole other heritage, not primate, we invented it, I think, of egalitarianism. And that is the key reason I think democracy will survive. You know, it's done not badly over the last 250 years, but it will survive because before we invented civilization for perhaps 100,000, perhaps more years, when we all lived in hunter-gatherer bands of 100 people, we all lived in totally egalitarian societies. Fanatically egalitarian societies. I mean, I know North American Native peoples better. You probably know Australian Aboriginal peoples better. But those societies have a heritage of equality, obsessively enforced equality, which goes back in an unbroken line to their ancestors probably 50,000, 40,000 years ago when they arrived here, and even before that.
And is that rational self-interest that's driving that
equality?
It is
exactly that. I mean, why would human beings become egalitarian when all of their primate relatives are not, and we've obviously still got that, you know, sort of set of reactions, instincts, if you like, in ourselves, but what we have is intelligence and language. And intelligence tells you that living in a society where one individual dominates everybody else would be great if you were that individual, but the odds that you will be that individual are very long against. So if you can't be or can't count on being the dominant person, then equality is a better option. And our very remote ancestors clearly figured that out. There's a phrase which is used in anthropology nowadays, a reverse dominance hierarchy. And this is about a revolution that happened probably, I mean, somewhere between 20 and 100,000 years ago, but probably rather towards the beginning of that period, where given that we could figure out we're going to lose if we go on playing this game, and given we have language and conspire with other people in the band who also have the same knowledge that they're probably going to lose this game, then you can collectively overthrow the Monkey King and impose absolute equality on the adult, at least the adult males. There was not much feminism involved in this. But even so, you know, equality is infectious once you get it. You can see the evidence of this in the social behavior of any people who have hunter-gatherer ancestors relatively recently, because the way they conduct their affairs ensures that nobody rises above the others. The tall poppies are cut down by mockery and so on, if possible, but by more extreme methods if necessary. The ultimate social crime is to give an order to another adult. That is
so if a prime minister couldn't help but show how much more money and intelligence he had than everyone else in his cabinet, that might not work out so well for him? Is that what
Probably
you're saying?
Probably not. So, you know, that is our heritage. We have a long heritage of living as equals. And even when that sort of 10,000-year night of tyranny, and you go into the mass civilizations and all those social controls cease to function because they can't function among a million people who are not in touch with each other. You can't conspire with all those people to stop the tall poppies from taking over. And besides, you know, now the societies are so big and complex, you need somebody to give orders, and you have no other way of choosing, you know, way of choosing good people. It's just the toughest rise to the top. 10,000 years of that, but even through that 10,000 years, in our own social lives, we maintain that egalitarianism. And we all have a circle of friends who are about 100 in number at the most, of whom we might know 20 or 30 well. And among those people, there is no hierarchy. We still treat them as equal to ourselves. To do otherwise would be a social crime. You'd be ostracized. Look at the great religions that arose 2,000 or 3,000 years ago. Every one of them defines complete equality among the believers in a world where there is no equality on the ground. So we have that, and as soon as we got the means to recreate that equality by mass media, by now we can communicate across the society, run the thing ourselves, we go for it. That's why I have confidence that democracy will survive.
We think we live in a bad time now, and it does feel like a bad time.
It's better than the 13th century.
Well, yeah, that's certainly true. But I can remember the first year I came to this university was 1982. This was in the depth of one of the worst periods of the Cold War. Tell me what you saw of the Cold War as a young naval officer.
Well, I was a very young naval officer. I was 19 years old at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, very freshly fledged naval officer at university. And they phoned me up and said, stand by to be mobilized. You may be going to sea in a couple of days. This was during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And I was talking to another chap who'd been in the Navy with me.
Sorry, this is 1962.
1962, yeah. I'm much older than I look. And I was talking to another fellow who'd been in the Navy with me, and both he and I took that as natural, inevitable. We expected it to happen. We lived with the bomb. We didn't learn to love it, but we accepted that that would probably be our fate. I had kids anyway. I mean, come on. But there was a real belief that the odds of making it out of the 20th century alive were pretty long against. It was real. I mean, long after that, in the 1980s, in 1982 or 3, I was making a television series about war. And one of the things I got to do was to go and talk to the people down in the missile silos, or not in the actual where the missile is, but in an underground capsule somewhere deep under North Dakota, where the control officers sat. Two of them each had a key, and if they both turned the keys at the same time, they could launch 50 missiles, a sort of field of 50 Minuteman missiles. So you go down in this very long lift. And I was talking to these two young officers who were going to deliver 50 missiles on the Soviet Union if the phone rang. And they were both studying for MBAs in their spare time. It's very boring down there. And I asked the older one of the two, who must have been all of 22, if that phone rang and the codes came over and you had to launch the missiles, what would you do? And he said, I'd do what I've been trained to do. There'd be no time for reflection. And I paused for a moment. I said, and what would you think afterwards, after you turned those keys? He said, there would be time for reflection then. It was real. I mean, it could have happened. It didn't happen, thank God. And we owe the peace movement and the military equal thanks for that.
I saw democracy come to Czechoslovakia in 1989 in the Velvet Revolution. You were in the Soviet Union where you saw the breakdown of the old Soviet Union.
Yeah.
You've been going there throughout the 80s at the height of the Cold War and you saw it collapse over time. Tell me about the first anti-communist demonstration you went along to in Moscow.
In summer of 1989. Yes, it was fascinating. I mean, I knew that Eastern Europe was in a ferment. But I spent that summer in the Soviet Union. I was doing a radio series this time and so on. But I had a lot of contacts. I mean, I actually met people like Yeltsin. He was easy. He just went in the basement of Parliament and offered him a vodka, and he'd come close to the table. So there's an announcement on the Bush Telegraph, so to speak, that there is going to be a march, an anti-communist march in Moscow. On this sort of 10-lane wide ring road, the Garden Ring Road, starting right outside the Foreign Ministry, big old Stalin gingerbread skyscraper. So I go along. Of course, I'm a journo, right? So but I'm scared because this is the heart of darkness here, the evil empire, and they're going to have an anti-communist demonstration in Moscow. So I go there, and the street is starting to fill up. There's an underground station right by it, and they're just coming out 100 and 200 a minute. And I'm doing what I normally do in that kind of situation where it could get ugly, which is you stay in the side of the crowd, stay on the pavement, and always have a doorway in mind that you could dodge into if the bullets start to fly. And then I notice that in the crowd, there are Soviet army officers in full uniform there to demonstrate against the communists. It's okay. I can go out in the middle of the street. It was such a, I mean, you know, if you knew the old Soviet Union in the bad days, which were only barely over, it was a revelation that Russians could behave like this, that Russians knew what we knew, that Russians were even confident. This was what, 3 months after, 2 months after Tiananmen Square in China, where they slaughtered all those kids. But the Russians figured our rulers have been 30 years more in power. They're completely shagged out. They will not turn to force if we go out. We can do nonviolence here. And they got away with it. And they brought down the Communist Party, and the old Soviet Union broke up, and, you know, there were many tears before bedtime, but it was a wonderful event.
I think what you say is true. There is a natural human inclination to long for democracy, perhaps, or some form of egalitarian society, and for justice too. Mm. But there's also another very powerful trait in humans, which is to long for security.
Yeah.
And for that, when you're feeling like security is threatened, you reach for a strong man. Well, people tend to reach, they want a strong man in power. That's what I think we've seen happen in Russia, isn't it? And doesn't that sort of stand in the way towards this kind of long-term shift towards greater democracy that you believe we're seeing in the world?
Well, I'm not a fan of Putin, clearly, but he actually has to get elected. The democratic institutions that were put in place in the 1990s in Russia, no longer the Soviet Union, are still in place, all of them. Now, he's perverted them, he's manipulated them. We've seen this in much better run countries than Russia from time to time. Yet, if he were to fall under a bus tomorrow, and his successor was unable to impose the same dominance on the system, you wouldn't need to change the laws or the constitution in Russia at all to go to a fully democratic country. And it's a well-educated population, and they've got various chips on their shoulders because they lost a big serious contest, and their old empire vanished, and their empire went a lot more recently than the Western European empire, so it still bears on them. This is why they get obsessed about things like Ukraine. But they could be democratic tomorrow. They're not a separate species. They're Europeans like the rest of them.
Since Donald Trump came to power, he's taken an interesting view of foreign affairs. He treats long-term allies like Australia, which has fought alongside the United States in countless wars, as parasites and hangers-on. Nonetheless, he's keen to express his admiration for people like Putin and Xi Jinping and other authoritarian leaders.
Because he admires them and would love to have as free a hand as they have.
Yeah. So do you see Trump as a genuine threat to world peace in that sense, to the stability of the world order such as it is and has been?
I used to say, well, the adults are still in the White House and could probably stop, and that's no longer true. He's got rid of all the adults. But the rest of the world is still run by grown-ups. Most of it. I mean, there are exceptions, clearly, but, you know, the Russians, the Chinese, the British, the French, the Australians, the America not at the moment. But they would have to be equally rash and stupid to let this topple into war. I mean, nobody wants a war anymore. Nobody thinks war is a good idea. Nobody imagines you can win a war and profit from it. The weapons won't let you do that anymore. So, you know, as long as you can trust Xi Jinping and Putin and the various Western European, Japanese, other industrial countries, not to be sucked into something that Trump starts, I think we're reasonably safe. If I'm wrong, you can give me a call just before you die. But but no, I think the grown-ups are still in charge elsewhere, and they would have to join the dance, too, for us to get to a global conflagration. I mean, nobody wants that.
I think what you're saying is the world is kind of approaching a fork in a road here. These certainly advanced economies like in the United States and your home Canada and Australia, we can go one way or another. Is that how you see it? There's some decisions we need to make now, our societies need to make now and in the near future. Otherwise, if we do this, or we'll have that. What is the this and the that of that future scenario, as you see it?
Well, I don't think it is democracy or no democracy. I think democracy in the world is not faced with extinction. There's a little bit of, you know, three steps forward, two steps back going on, but that's normal in human affairs. There is a, you know, look at it over a period of several decades, and any three decades you take shows advances in democracy for the last 150 years. And we're a long way from where we started. So that's not the fork in the road that I worry about. And it's not war either, really. I agree it's still there. The weapons are certainly still there. But we've kind of come to terms with not using them because we have internalized what the consequences would be. Great powers don't fight each other. 73 years now. But I do worry about another fork in the road, which is the whole question of climate change. I mean, I think that is the top issue. Will we respond? You could still probably fix it. You'd suffer, you know, you'd take some losses, but if you got serious about it, you could probably avoid going over the edge now, and maybe you got another 5 years. Doubt you have another 10. Of course, the worst consequences won't come for 20 or 30 years, but you'll be locked on course after that. So that's the kind of decision you got to make. Then you worry about what kind of governments have you got, and have they got the courage to take those decisions, and will the population support them? I mean, that's really what the key political and geopolitical question is. I mean, this is going to have far more impact than anything we do in the traditional political sphere.
Governments in Australia have tried and failed to come up with coherent climate policies over the last 10 years, and it's brought down several prime ministers. Climate policy in this country,
yeah,
again and again and again, and most recently with Malcolm Turnbull being, yeah, one of the key factors in that. It seems that the problem is the mechanisms of democracy seem to be seizing up just at the moment when some kind of resolution, proper resolve is required.
Well, it does feel that way. I'm not sure it really is. I mean, the kind of, you know, the ridiculous last 5 years you've had in Australia I suspect that is not the future of Australian democracy. That is, will be looked back upon as a particularly silly period.
It's a nice egalitarian method of making everyone in Australia prime minister eventually.
Well, it's, you know,
you could see that.
15
that.
Minutes per person,
yeah,
right?
That's right. Yeah. I'd have fun with my 15 minutes, I know. Yeah.
But what we have at the moment is a drift towards populism, which is a response to a problem we're going to have to fix, which is the anger of a very large proportion of the electorate who are already unemployed or anticipate being unemployed and feel neglected and betrayed. You know, this is within human, look, we did it once. We had the 30s. It ended up in the Second World War, 50 million dead, most of the cities in the world smashed flat. And after that, remembering how people like Hitler came to power and the mass unemployment and the despair, we built welfare states all through the West, and it did work in the sense that you now got 17% unemployment in the United States, and they're not marching in the street, and the cops aren't shooting them down because the welfare state dampens down. So we did that once. We can do it again. And I think we probably will. I mean, with how many casualties and how long will it take, another question, but we will do it again because this is actually an old problem. You just, you know, got to deal with a different set of factors, but you know how to do this. And frankly, universal basic income is simply an elaboration of the welfare state as a concept. But whether we will have sane governments again and not have to spend all our time fending off the crazies in time to deal with real issues like climate change is a burning question. I don't know the answer to that one.
Ladies and gentlemen, please thank Gwyn Dyer. Gwyn Dyer's book is called Growing Pains, and that conversation was recorded at the ANU in Canberra in the splendid Great Hall at University House. Our thanks to our very deft tech producers, Mark Jennings and Christian Zappa, and to the Canberra Writers' Festival. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.